This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
And from our office in Canada, we have Daniel DeSanto.
Hello.
It is September 11th, 2020, the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on America. If you didn't get a chance to hear Mr. Stephen Fleury this morning, do listen to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show from today. It's a very moving reminder of what happened on that day and how America responded to it. You see the unity in America at that time. There was just an outpouring of patriotism after those attacks. And it really is a stark contrast to open your eyes to what is happening today. Just a valuable perspective on how much America is hurting itself today. On today's Week in Review, we're going to start with a couple of positive stories. First, an encouraging economic agreement between two bitter rivals in Eastern Europe. And second, another development in the peace that is building between Arab states and the Jewish state of Israel. Both of these stories you're not going to hear much about in the mainstream news in America because, well, they both reflect positively on President Donald Trump, who had a hand in both of those situations. But even among news sources that do report on these stories, the Trumpet is going to give you a really unique perspective because in both cases, Bible prophecy shows there's more going on here than would first appear. First, we'll look at this agreement in Europe between Serbia and Kosovo. For this story, we'll go to Daniel DeSanto.
Right. So United States President Donald Trump has accomplished a major foreign policy breakthrough. And as you said, we don't usually hear about this in the media. This has been downplayed or basically ignored throughout it. But this is actually something that was, in a way, quite unexpected because nobody else has been able to do this. So what happened was Serbia and Kosovo, with negotiating with the United States, have agreed to normalize relations with each other. And that was announced on September 4th. So this is an economic agreement. It's setting up a common market. It removes the tariffs between those two nations. It integrates different energy and water resources that they have. It's renewing transportation links as well, which have been completely severed even since the 90s, since the wars over there. So to help give you an idea of just how momentous this actually is, it's really good to take a look at some of the history from there. For example, well, we know that the Balkans have always been an area of conflict. We know that World War I had some of its origins in issues in the Balkans. We know that in the 1990s, there was a war there where Germany was heavily involved, where the U.S., ended up siding with Germany and bombing its old allies, the Serbs. The 1800s even and 1900s saw competition between Serbia and Bulgaria, trying to dominate the Ottoman Empire's influence as that fell apart in Europe. So this area has been just basically a powder keg of instability for centuries. Even the only real time of stability, or one of the few times of stability, was under a strongman dictator, which was under Josip Tito. He was the dictator there in for a few years, but he died in the 80s. And just after that, not about 10 years after that, it exploded in war again. So this has been something that many people have tried to do to get peace in the Balkans, but nobody has been able to do it. The EU has been trying to do this as well. There have been recently some major EU efforts there, but only President Donald Trump has been able to do this. And this is something that probably gets his adversaries very upset, but it is still a remarkable deal which has been able to accomplish here.
So tell us some of the details of the deal that they forged.
All right, well, so the EU has been trying to do this for about 10 years and it failed. Now, what this is basically it's trying to bring economic stability so they will recognize each other these two nations will recognize each other, normalize their relations, and be able to trade without tariffs on their products. So this will basically make it, this will basically remove the longstanding barriers that have been standing there for years, for even decades.
There's also something in the deal that really caught my attention was the fact that both of these entities, Serbia and Kosovo, agreed to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The fact that the deal was predicated on their both recognizing Israel was quite extraordinary, and the fact that they agreed to it. Talk about that for a little bit.
Yes, well, it was, again, this was part of President Donald Trump's making as well. He's the one who had that deal between Israel and the UAE just recently, and that kind of opened the floodgates, as we've talked about before. So this is quite unusual. Now, a lot of times President Donald Trump, because he's being ostracized by the international community, by traditional allies such as those in Europe, and right now it's been turning to some other nations, to some more non-traditional alliances to continue being a player on the world scene. And that includes making deals with nations such as Kosovo and Bosnia here. So this is the same thing for Israel. Israel is a country that's been ostracized a lot, and then by international organizations, by other countries. So this is a big step forward here, is these nations which really have been ostracized in the past 4 years because of the Trump administration, because those nations, the other nations, don't like the direction Trump is taking in the U.S. This is a great step forward for their foreign policy as well, because it gives them good relations and it gives them trading opportunities and economic development opportunities, which they otherwise would not probably not have.
We have an article up on the website by Simon Zekic, who is our on staff Serbian, and did an excellent job with this article. And he, of course, points to the fact that this is part of this resurgence in America that we're seeing. This is part of a broader trend of these foreign policy victories that the United States has been having under Donald Trump. But that's an interesting aspect of this that he covers pretty well in that article. But looking at the what this means for these former Yugoslavian nations and what this means for their relationship with Europe, talk about why this is significant in terms of what we may see within Europe going forward.
Right. Well, we know that for these nations, Europe has tried to get these nations, bring them into the fold. Now, we know, of course, that hasn't been very successful. The EU has tried to thwart the U.S. When it announced war crime charges against Prime Minister Thaçi not too long ago, just back in June. That was specifically targeted to stop an American meeting that was trying to broker this same deal, this deal which has just been made. So we know that Europe also has a claim and wants to take the Balkans for itself. Our booklet, we have a free booklet that we offer. It's called Germany's Conquest of the Balkans. And that booklet explains essentially that, well, the Bible talks about a 10-nation superpower rising in Europe. And that 10-nation superpower is going to have two parts to it. It's going to have a Western leg, so to speak, and an Eastern leg. This is taken from the Daniel 2 image. And there's two legs, so one is in the West, one is in the East. And Mr. Armstrong often wrote, for example, in a 1980 co-worker letter, that there will be nations in the East as well, possibly, quite possibly, the Balkan nations as well, which were formerly, of course, under communism. But he wrote about those coming under the rule of Europe and coming into Catholicism as well.
Well, here, having that prophetic perspective on what's happening here is so critical. Gerald Flory's booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, shows just how determined Europe has been to get the Balkans under its rule, so that it has access to the Adriatic and to the Mediterranean, and the conquests that it plans to make in the future, and that the Bible prophesies of, require that that geography. That's really why Herbert Armstrong was pointing to the former Yugoslavia as being a likely member of that 10-nation alliance that you're describing. But the fact that the United States is empowering these nations and clearing obstacles to their being able to join with that European Federation is quite interesting. The United States has done a lot over the years to empower that European coming superstate. And so here we see another instance of the United States doing that. We do have, I really recommend that you look at this article by Simon Zekic on the website, U.S. President Brokers Deal Between Serbia and Kosovo. We'll link to that, as well as Gerald Fleury's booklet, Germany's Conquest of the Balkans, in the show notes for today's program. And we'll continue to keep our eyes on how that unfolds and how Europe takes advantage of this peace deal that they have announced between these two countries. Thanks very much for that, Daniel. Now to the Middle East and a remarkable decision by the Arab League in support of the peace deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel. For this, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
This Wednesday, the Arab League got together and they were going to discuss the peace deal, as you mentioned, that was struck between the UAE and Israel, again by President Donald Trump back on August 14th. And it's surprising because every time that the Palestinians have come to the Arab League wanting some type of joint resolution condemning Israel for something, they have given them a free pass and said, we stamp our approval on this. But not this time. The Palestinians wanted the Arab League to reject that normalization deal, and yet the Arab League said that they weren't going to do that. They said it was the prerogative of each state to come up with its own foreign national policy, its own foreign policy ideas, and the Palestinians went away quite upset over this. Of course, it has been the Arab position up until August 14th that there would be no normalization with Israel, no peace with Israel, until Israel withdrew back to the 1967 lines and basically gave the Palestinians the West Bank. Israel hasn't done that. UAE came through with the deal and said, we'll do it. The Palestinians are upset, justifiably, I would think, in terms of what the Arabs have said for so long. It's the Arabs that are changing here, not necessarily the Palestinian position. Mm-hmm. And yet the Arab League, which is a bunch of nations, 22 nations in North Africa, the Middle East, not including Iran, not including Turkey, they all came out and together, all of them said, no way, Palestinians, where with Israel and the UAE on this deal?
We've had a few indications that there would be broader Arab support for this deal. This seems like about the strongest vindication of this peace deal that we've seen so far.
Yeah, and you can kind of expect that as well. If President Trump is going to come out very loudly with this peace deal, you're going to expect that other nations have already bought in. Saudi Arabia has already approved it. The Egyptians have probably approved it for the time being as well. We know that Bahrain and Saudi Arabia opened up their airspace to all Israeli jets last week. And then we also know that President Trump said yesterday that at the official signing of this deal, which is going to happen on September 15th in the White House with Netanyahu and some others, there might be another Arab state that is joined to the list by that time. So we are seeing a huge shift in the Middle East where there is, at least temporarily, acceptance of the Jewish state over championing the Palestinian cause.
Now, we have written about just how this UAE deal does show the division between one group of Arab states in the region and another group led by Iran, and that it is kind of an anti-Iranian move on the part of the UAE, recognizing that the more they align with other powers in the region, the stronger united stance that they can take against Iran. Maybe you can just talk about what this may mean in terms of Iranian influence in the region. If the Palestinians feel like the Arab League is turning their back on them, does that not maybe open a door for Iran?
Yeah, if you look at the nations that were championing the Palestinian cause, saying that, you know, the UAE has stabbed the Muslim world in the back by this type of deal with Israel. It was Iran and Turkey. And we expect, you know, Iran to become louder and louder as the champion of the Palestinian people. Now, up until this point, you did have Iran over one of the factions of the Palestinians, Hamas, that is located mainly in the Gaza Strip. But what you're seeing is that both Palestinian factions, Fatah leading the West Bank, that has not historically been on side with Iran, is probably going to shift its stance. Last week, we had the first time in a decade, we had the Palestinian factions, all of them getting together, virtually, of course. Nevertheless, they got together and they said that we want reconciliation. We've got 5 weeks to go away and come back, and we're going to get back together so we have a national front. They've been split for so long, and Iran's only backed one of those powers, one of the sides, one of the factions. And now you've had the Palestinians that look at this point to be getting their act together on national reconciliation amongst them. And then once that happens, Fatah isn't going to find a friend in the Arab League like it always has. It's only going to be able to find a friend in perhaps Turkey and Iran. And we expect Iran to become the dominant player pushing for the Palestinian cause, not any of these other so-called Arab moderate states that have championed the Palestinian cause in the past. And we can certainly see that the Palestinians are being pushed over to the Iranian camp even more as the rest of the Arab world rejects them.
You say we expect the Palestinians to side with the Iranians. Why is that?
Well, based on biblical prophecy, we understand that there is going to be a play for Jerusalem by the Palestinians from the West Bank. And this is based from a prophecy in Zechariah that talks about half of Jerusalem falling. Right now, all of Jerusalem is under the control of the Israelis, and that is something that we do expect to change based on that prophecy. And the only player that has historically, and if you look over the, let's say, the past 20 years, really been willing to foment violence against Israel and really fund that violence against Israel, it is Iran. If you look what Hezbollah is doing in the north, what they've done with Hamas, what they've done on the Syrian border as well, it's always Iran backing these proxies to try and fight against Israel. And we do expect that that it is going to be the Palestinians that make this play, a violent play for control of the West Bank, and that to be supported by the Iranians. The Iranians have, well, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, has called Jerusalem the crown jewel in Iran's plans for the Middle East. That's what they want, and they're going to use the Palestinians to try and get it. And the Palestinian people now are being pushed in a direction of the Iranian camp rather than accepting more general Arab support.
Quite remarkable to see how these fault lines within the region are shaping up. Where would you send people to learn more about how prophecy is playing a role here?
Yeah, the book that's best going to describe, I would say, the play of the Palestinians around Jerusalem and the state of Israel, it is definitely Jerusalem in Prophecy, written by Gerald Fleury. This book goes into more than just this prophecy. It also talks about what happens after half of Jerusalem is taken by the Palestinians and how that will further other end time events.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent. Over to Asia now, where China continues to expand its influence, this time gaining more power over the Southeast Asian nation of Laos. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, just to give a little context to this development, it was back in 2013 that Chinese President Xi Jinping announced his plan to rebuild the ancient Silk Road. That was the network of trade routes and in ancient times that just facilitated the movement of goods and ideas across Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. And Xi Jinping said he would make just kind of a new and improved version of it. He'd be building all kinds of road and rail and ports and other infrastructure projects in dozens of nations, and that it would all be designed to just better connect the rest of the world to China. And the nation of Laos was one of the first to sign up. Laos is landlocked, and it only has about 7 million people, so it's never had, you know, a very strong economy. And it was very eager for China to come in and loan them hundreds of millions of dollars to build the country up. So China built a major high-speed railway there. One of the bridges on this railway is a real feat of engineering. It's it ended up setting a world record for the longest span between two piers, and a couple of other records as well. And then Laos also let China come in and build some major hydroelectric projects. Laos has some rivers in mountainous areas that make it just a prime candidate to generate vast amounts of hydroelectric power. So it was trying to turn itself into the battery of Southeast Asia. That was the nicknames that the Laotians gave themselves because of these projects. So it all seemed great for Laos. But as early as 2018, the Center for Global Development began to warn Laos that all of these loans that it was taking from China for these projects were piling up and putting the nation at risk of default. But Laos didn't really heed those warnings. And this week, news broke that the Laotians were not able to repay those loans. They weren't servicing them on time. And so a big state-owned Chinese firm called the China Southern Power Grid Company has now stepped in because of this, and they signed a deal this week that gives China majority control over Laos's electrical grid. So it's, you know, a huge loss for the Laotian people and an equally large gain for China.
We've seen this pattern play out repeatedly where China has built infrastructure or made loans, and then when the people who are the recipients of this supposed largesse are unable to repay, then China steps in and takes over one segment of society or other, or, you know, exacts some kind of a punishment by extending its influence. What is it that it gains specifically from doing this in Laos?
Yeah, well, you know, part of it has to do specifically with the hydroelectric power that Laos can generate. China will now be well positioned to control who buys that electricity and for how much. China will profit from that. And it will just have greater influence over Southeast Asia in general because of controlling that. But in a general sense, this move makes Laos just a big step closer to being kind of a vassal to China. Brian Eiler is the Southeast Asia Program Director of the Stimson Center think tank. And he spoke about this yesterday. He said, quote, "Giving China a major stake in the battery of Southeast Asia plan puts Laos fast on the track of becoming a pseudo-province of China." So, you know, that's pretty blunt language there, but that's really what is happening here, not just with Laos, but as you mentioned, with a lot of nations that Xi Jinping has hooked with his promises to build infrastructure projects related to the Belt and Road Initiative. He's able to get them so deeply into debt that they have to sign parts of their country over to what is basically Chinese control. You know, Sri Lanka is the big one that we often mention, but there's a whole string of other countries that are at great risk of also having to forfeit parts of their nations to China. And now we can add Laos to this list.
Why is it so important that we watch China's actions in cases like this?
Well, it's there are plenty of geopolitical reasons for it, but the main reason is because of what Bible prophecy says about China in the very near future. Isaiah chapter 23 talks about a mighty trade block that will be formed in our lifetimes, and it'll be so powerful that it will eventually be able to block the United States and the United Kingdom out of world trade. It's called a Mart of Nations in verse 3 of that chapter. And one of the main powers in this block is a nation called Chittim. And that is an ancient name for modern China. So when we see China right now slowly taking over nations like Laos and just becoming so much stronger and just exerting its influence more broadly over more and more of its neighbors, it is building Beijing's power, and it's creating the foundation for China or Chittim to play a major role in that that Mart of Nations trade bloc.
Well, we do have an article called Brave New World Made in China explaining that prophecy that we will link to in the show notes, as well as our booklet Russia and China in Prophecy. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. We'll look now at these devastating wildfires sweeping across California and the West Coast. We'll get a unique perspective on what's happening there from Andrew Miller.
Yeah, many of you have probably seen the pictures if you've watched any like television or even internet news of just the red glowering skies and the flames engulfing millions of acres across the West Coast. I guess the latest statistics we have in from Oregon show that there's been 500,000 people displaced due to these fires. And just to put that in context, Oregon, there's only 4.2 million people living there. So that's more than 10% of the entire state's population has had to leave their homes because they're either burning or at risk of being burnt in the very near future. The number of displaced has been quite a bit less in California, only 30,000. I guess only 30,000. But that's still a pretty high number just because the fires are in more rural areas. But to date, there's been 2.5 million acres burnt down in California alone. That's 20 times more than was burnt last year at about this time. The fire season's still ongoing, so more will go down. So this is a lot worse than last year. There is a wildfire season every year in these states, but it's 20 times worse than last year. And the New York Times is saying the worst fires in modern history. Now, for the New York Times, I guess modern history starts about in the 1940s, because I think it was sometime in the 80s that the federal government started keeping official tallies of how many acres burnt down. Mm-hmm. So before that, you either have to look at local records or conduct a study by like counting tree rings and seeing like, the oldest tree is this old, therefore they almost have burnt down.
So,
many years ago.
Of course, whenever this happens, you immediately have the individuals claiming this is due to climate change.
Right. And you, even that the governor of California on Wednesday came out and said that I have no patience for climate change deniers, in context of saying that, well, these fires definitely prove climate change. And then a relative of his or an in-law of his, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, came out the next day and said that Mother Nature is angry with us. So I guess there's maybe a little confusion as to whether it's Mother Nature that's angry at us or whether it was climate change, that man-made climate change that's responsible for it. But yeah, that is the claim. And I mean, it is pretty undeniable that wildfires are usually worse when there's a drought. So I mean, that's what he's talking about. He's like, California is in a mild drought this year and was in a severe drought 2 or 3 years back. And so they're blaming this on carbon dioxide emissions as causing droughts and making these fires, which there's a few things wrong with. First of all, there's, like I said, the science linking the burning of carbon dioxide with drought is really dodgy. And second of all, like I said, it's like 2 years ago, the drought was way worse. And yet, like, a fraction of the acreage that's burnt down this year burnt down then. So it's not just drought. Actually, a lot of conservatives are making a much more compelling case that the problem there is that in the Forestry Service, the liberal preservationists are refusing to clear out the underbrush because they want it natural. That's something I remember. I studied biology at Central Michigan University, and I was fortunate in that a lot of the professors there were radical leftists. But they had one natural resource conservation professor, Doug Valick, who old school, getting ready to retire, but old school conservationist, where he always really stressed that he's like, there's a difference between conserving and managing natural resources and preserving the earth in its natural state. He's like, managing natural resources means managing natural resources.
Intervention.
Intervention. And the forest fire debate was actually even a big thing then. This is back about 2002, 2003. where in Michigan at the time, there'd been a lot of like the liberals saying that, well, we want to preserve the natural environment and just don't intervene with it. Whereas more of the more conservative people in the Department of Natural Resources are saying, we got all this underbrush that it needs to be cleared out periodically, which means you've either got to cut it down or do a controlled burn. And that's really what you're seeing in California right now is the entire state's this giant tinderbox of dry underbrush. Mm-hmm. The liberals can blame that on, oh, well, global warming's caused drought, and that's made the underbrush too dry. But you can get rid of that with a controlled burn. Actually, some of those studies I mentioned earlier said that, like, before people, like, or at least before Europeans settled in California, you'd routinely get huge wildfires burn 4-5 million acres. And then as people live there and cleared some of the trees, built farms, started clearing out underbrush, you get the number of acreage that burns each year is a fraction of what it used to be. And so really what you're seeing is that now if you're these liberals in the Forest Service, they're not clearing out this underbrush, you're really kind of returning California to what it was before people, or at least before white people, settled there. That's probably something a lot of California liberals would really love to see, is the influence of white Europeans completely abolished in their state. But the fact of the matter is that, like I said, this is a mix between drought and not clearing out this underbrush.
Essentially, a failure of managing the land properly.
Right, because the drought. I mean, you're pretty reliant on God for it. You just got to pray for rain, and it'll rain when God feels like making it rain. The clearing the underbrush is something that people can do something about. And as a matter of fact, that was like close to the first instruction God ever gave mankind, is to dress and keep the Garden of Eden. And dressing and keeping does not involve just leaving all this underbrush in the forest surrounding your cities and towns lying around like a giant tinderbox for as soon as a flame hits it to burn down vast portions of the land. I mean, that is what happened before people lived there. But now, I mean, with people living there, if you don't want to just set your state on fire, that's something you have to do something about. So there's a number of factors at play here. I mean, in part, this is kind of a direct violation of God's command to dress and keep the planet he gave us by refusing to clear out this underbrush. But the drought also does factor in as well, not necessarily because you're too much car emissions, but just because the Bible is very clear that God does send droughts as punishment for moral sins, which there's plenty of in California. There's one prophecy here that we'll bring up in Isaiah 29, verse 6, that's directed towards end-time Israel, that says, "You shall be visited by the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake, with great noise, with storm and tempest, and a flame of devouring fire." And so no one can argue that California has recently been visited by the flame of devouring fire. And you can debate as to how much the drought's to blame and how much the underbrush is to blame. But you can't debate that Isaiah kind of called this one 2,500 years ago, mm-hmm. which is amazing that you can. I'm sure Isaiah knew very, very little about the internal politics of the California Forest Service, but he definitely did know that when sins come, one way or another, you will see these prophecies come to pass. And actually, that there's a section in there. It's in our Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet, which we'll put in the show notes. There's a chapter in there where that gets into that verse, and now I think that chapter is more about the earthquake part of the verse, but the earthquakes and the fires are mentioned in the same verse and for the same reason, for punishment on end time Israel for sins. And that chapter in the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet will explain that.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. We are going to take a short break, and we will be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
When 9/11 happened 19 years ago today, the United States entered immediately into war in the Middle East and Asia, first in Afghanistan and then 2 years later in Iraq. Both of those wars have continued ever since, with very limited and very fragile success. But President Donald Trump is working hard to try to bring both of these wars to an end. For news on the latest of these efforts, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
United States General Frank McKenzie announced this week that the United States is going to withdraw a number of troops from both Iraq and Afghanistan. The number from Iraq that is going to come out is about 2,200, taking the number from just over 5,000 to 3,000 troops that are going to remain in that country. This brings the total down, all the way down from 170,000 at its peak back during the surge, back in the early, in the middle 2000s. And President Trump has said, obviously, that he wants to bring these boys home. He wants to stop fighting wars inside the Middle East, other people's battles. And so he hopes, and at least the general said that he hopes this to be done in the next month or so. So this is something that will be before the election, that 2,000 U.S. servicemen are going to come home from Iraq.
There's no question but that these have been largely failed efforts in both of these theaters. And the fact that Donald Trump is recognizing that, and the fact that he is essentially saying our presence there is not serving the purpose for which it was intended, we need to bring them out. It's hard to argue with the underlying logic here. Put it in the context of what we have been watching for and just what this says about America's might overall.
Right. So two things. If we're going to talk about Afghanistan, you know, we wrote from the very beginning that we went in there that this was not going to be a successful mission, that America would spend its strength in vain, as it is prophesied in the book of Leviticus. And we've seen that, all the blood and the money that's gone into this. And right now in Afghanistan, we've got the United States that is negotiating with the Taliban, the very people it was meant to destroy, so that it can exit. And here in Iraq, while Saddam Hussein was removed, we said back in 2003, and Mr. Gerald Flurry made big statements about this, that this is going to pave the way for an Iranian takeover of the Iraqi state. And that's what we have seen ever since 2004. Initially, we had Iran that was quite worried about 100,000 U.S. servicemen were on its border just to its west. But eventually, with Qasem Soleimani's work, and they started to fight against the American servicemen there, causing almost 1,000 American deaths in Iraq. And so every time that the United States withdraws men, we always come back to this fact that Iran is going to fill in that vacuum inside Iraq. And this is what other people are noting as well. Seth Franzman, noted commentator in the Middle East, he talked about how Iran is going to view this as a win for them. Almost daily, U.S. bases get hit by rockets. It's not reported anymore, but that's still happening inside Iraq. And so the United States is not leaving victorious. The quote from McKenzie was all about how our Iraqi brothers are going to be continuing the fight against the Islamic State. While the Islamic State might be the token reason for the troops being there, we all know that the U.S. presence in Iraq was to stop Iran's takeover, or partly to stop Iran's takeover of that country. And as much as it's going to be played out or shown to be a success of bringing these people home, it is a grand failure of almost two decades of war in Iraq to see that this country is eventually, and especially without U.S. presence, going to fall into the hands of Iran.
I think of all the prophecies that we've highlighted over the years at the Trumpet, what has happened in the Middle East, in Afghanistan and Iraq, have to be among the most dramatic in terms of seeing them fulfilled. Where would you send people to learn more about what we have been saying about this all along and why this is important?
Yeah, I think we've actually got an article up right now. It's by Warren Reich entitled "America's Dwindling Power in Iraq Paves Way for Iran's Conquest." He goes through several quotes from Mr. Gerald Flurry from the past to show how the door has been opened for an Iranian conquest of that nation, and how that the United States is not going to be successful in this. And we've been saying this from 2003 onwards. And then also going back to 1994 and 1995, Mr. Flurry said that Iraq would eventually fall to Iran. These were sworn enemies at the time he made that statement. And then once Saddam Hussein was removed, a pathway became clear for this prophecy to be fulfilled. It's taken almost two decades. But now the United States, with 3,000 men in the country, how long is it going to be before they get out of the country as well? And that'll be a great, it'll be a great testament to biblical prophecy and to the forecast of the trumpet. But it won't result in peace for Iraqis in the short term.
All right. We will link to that article by Warren Reich in the show notes, or you can check it out. It's right there on the front page of thetrumpet.com right now. And thank you very much, Brent. We've been following the unrest in Belarus and looking for signs of how Russian President Vladimir Putin may take advantage of this to increase Russia's power over this former Soviet satellite state. We got some strong signs this week. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, there was a big announcement on Tuesday from the Defense Ministry of Belarus. They said that Belarus's military, along with forces from Russia, would hold military drills in Belarus starting the next day. And then, sure enough, on Wednesday, forces from Russia arrived in Belarus to stage these military exercises. They have a total of 1,500 troops taking part. So these exercises are happening right now in Belarus's southeastern city of Brest, and the drills are supposed to last until September 15th. So 5 days altogether, and it looks like quite an impressive size to these war games.
Everything that has been happening in Belarus, and now with these war games taking place in Belarus, this is all something that European leaders are very, very in tune with, just given their mistrust of Vladimir Putin and his intentions in Eastern Europe.
Yes. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that is definitely very much on the radar of the Europeans. And that's in large part because Belarus has long functioned as kind of a buffer between Russia and Europe. So right now, to have military exercises that include Russia taking place there, that would be viewed by some, I think, in Europe, maybe quite a few, as kind of an advance by Russia toward Europe's heart. And that would be quite alarming to many in Europe. And one other interesting part of this story is that the Balkan nation of Serbia that we discussed in the first half originally was planning to take part in these military exercises. Serbia maintains close ties to Moscow, and when the Defense Ministry of Belarus announced these drills on Tuesday, they originally said that both Russia and Serbia would be coming to Belarus to take part in the games. But then Serbia came out at the last minute and said the European Union had pressured them to withdraw, to pull out of the games. So the EU apparently told Serbia that if they wanted to continue their plan to join the European Union, they'd have to drop out of these war games. So the Serbs did announce very regretfully that they were pulling out. But I think that gives us a clue just how closely the Europeans are watching these kinds of moves by Russia. And just by, you know, it helps us see how frightened by Russia's rise many in Europe are becoming.
Well, the language that you just used about Europe being frightened by Russia is language that comes directly from an article that our editor-in-chief wrote some years ago based on a very specific biblical prophecy. We've been watching that very closely ever since. This ties right in with that.
Yes, that was an article that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry wrote back in 2004. That was at a time when Vladimir Putin's, you know, his dictatorial colors were just beginning to show because of an election that he had manipulated in order to keep himself in power. And Mr. Flurry's article was called "Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy." And one part of it says, "This strikes intense fear in Europe. the Europeans still remember how violent Russia was in World War II, and Russia is a close neighbor with massive piles of nuclear weapons. Russia is triggering a fear that will hasten the uniting of the European Union. It will cause Germany and other European nations to want a strong leader. Throughout history, Germany has often sought a strong leader, and Bible prophecy says it'll do so again for one last time. And, you know, from there, Mr. Flurry points to prophecies that you mentioned in the book of Daniel showing that in time Europe will be terrified of Russia's military rise at a certain point. So I think right now when we see Russia rattling its sabers there in Belarus, holding these war games right on Europe's doorstep, you can really see that Europe already has significant fear of the belligerence of Putin's Russia. And that fear is, as Mr. Flurry wrote, one of the factors that's prompting the Europeans to want to unite.
Russia frightens Europe and fulfills Bible prophecy. It was Gerald Flurry's article back in 2004, as Jeremiah mentioned. We'll link to it in our show notes. And it really does provide important context to what's happening today in Belarus. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Tensions in the Mediterranean between Greece and Turkey also continue to boil, and it's provoking Greece to substantially beef up its military. For this story, we'll go back to Daniel DeSanto.
Greece has been majorly boosting its military spending, especially just over the past month. And tomorrow, actually, the Prime Minister of Greece will be announcing specifically some more measures that they will be taking. But as of now, we already know that Greece is going to be buying torpedoes from Germany and most likely upgrading its submarines, which are also German-made. It's going to be buying 18 fighter jets from France, and France is the major, I think, its biggest export partner with regards to military equipment at the moment. But it's also going to be buying from the Netherlands. It may also buy from the UK or even the US. But what's happening right now is that the conflict over these islands in the Mediterranean, over Turkish gas exploration and drilling, is really pushing Greece to militarize. And this is something we wouldn't necessarily expect from a country which has just been through a terrible financial crisis not too many years ago. It's still suffering economically. It's not in the best financial condition. And the Prime Minister has talked about sacrifices having to be made. Right now, they're using an opportunity that they have because the EU has relaxed some of those rules on paying back on Greece paying back its debt. So they're using this opportunity to actually strengthen the military. Now, of course, there's no plan right now for how they will make up this shortfall. It's supposed to be about 10 billion over a 10-year period. Of course, that could change in the future, but right now about 1.5 billion already is set to be spent in the coming few months. So Greece is really trying to make a sprint forward in the area of its military, taking advantage of some EU leniency, perhaps, on during the coronavirus measures that the EU has imposed. But really, this is a major step forward for Greece militarily, and also remains to be seen how it will impact it economically. But it will certainly make Greece a lot more dependent on Europe.
It's interesting how Europe is playing both sides in some ways. There's definitely indications we've talked about quite a lot of the relationship that it is maintaining with Turkey despite a lot of problems in that relationship. And then here it's really taking Greece's side in this conflict. How is it benefiting from that?
Well, Europe is really benefiting by playing both sides, strengthening the European arms industry. And we're seeing Germany as well as France benefit from the competition here. So what we're seeing really is that even though, you know, Europe is playing both sides, even though there's tension, eventually these two, even Turkey and Europe, are going to draw closer together. We've talked about this as a trend to watch for a lot on the trumpet. This is the SOM 83 alliance, as we've discussed, and Mr. Gerald Flurry has an article in the May-June 2011 trumpet titled A Mysterious Prophecy, which basically goes through Psalm 83 and shows that there is a prophesied alliance between Turkey and Germany. And really, one of Europe's greatest arms exporters is Germany. So as it seems like there is tension here, this is really just helping Germany to get stronger, and eventually Germany and Turkey will be working together.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you very much for that, Daniel. One final story back to California, which is in the vanguard of the radicalization of America's public schools. So to learn about this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we mentioned in the first half a little bit about some of the moral sins in California being behind prophecies about these wildfires. And this is actually a really good example of that, as they've actually, the Senate has passed an education bill so radical that President Trump has threatened to defund any California school that adopts it this week. The bill was passed actually by the House of Representatives in California last year, but the California Senate had refused to pass it just until August 20th of this year. But it basically it mandates, if the governor of California signs it, a semester-long ethics studies class that all Californian students have to take to graduate. But the ethics studies class is based on the New York Times 1619 Project, which, for those who haven't heard of it, is a project by the New York Times claiming that America wasn't really founded in 1776 with the signing of the Declaration of Independence. It was founded in 1619 when the first ship of indentured servants or slaves, as the 1619 Project refers to them, arrived in Virginia. And so it's very much in the same spirit of like Howard Zinn's People's History of America, saying that America is a country founded on the genocide of the Native Americans and the slavery of the African Americans. And many historians have already gone through what the New York Times has done and said this is much more about politics than it is about history, because there's just some gross historical errors in this project. And yet the California school system, or the California Senate now, is pushing to get this in the California school system, where all school students basically have to learn about the racist, genocidal past of their country. That's why it was on Sunday, actually, I believe it was, early this week anyway, that President Trump came out and said that the Department of Education, it's investigating this bill, and saying that if the investigation comes poorly, I guess California can do what it wants, but the California schools do receive federal funds, and Trump saying that he's not giving federal funds to any school that teaches this program that just warps history to present America's founding fathers almost as if they were members of the Nazi party or something like that.
You have to give the leftists credit for exploiting every conceivable tool and weapon that they have in their box to advance their agenda.
Right. Actually, I should try to find it and keep it in my quote trove. But I read an article from Mark Stein a few years ago that was basically saying that like Republicans fight to win elections, political elections, while leftists fight to win like the election for your child's parent teacher association meeting. He said, so when you play the long game, the leftists always win.
Yeah.
Because they really in some ways put a much higher education on like early childhood education than conservatives do, who for some reason seem more interested in winning political elections. And so now you have this movement like, well, we're going to make America great again by electing President Trump. Like, well, that's helped, but his average supporter is over age 45. So
right.
This is kind of like a last hurrah for the baby boomers. But what are your kids learning?
Yeah.
And we have a couple articles we can put in the show notes. One's on the website right now that I wrote on Black Lives Matter hijacks U.S. public schools. And then the other one's older from our March print edition on but like what are your children learning in public schools, and both of those do just really expose some shocking examples of the extremes that leftists are going to educate even even preschool children. I think the one I wrote this week even talks about like teaching your preschoolers about the 13 guiding principles of Black Lives Matter, which includes building like transgender affirming networks and disrupting the Western nuclear family in favor of like this collective system where every child is raised by the village. And yeah, it's some pretty shocking things when you go through all those that these radical Marxists are banking that like even if they can't get the presidency back this fall, these kindergarteners they'll be adults in 15 years. So it's
right. Yeah, it's an excellent point, and it's something that every parent should be very attentive to, because so many of us send our kids off to school and don't really pay attention to what they're learning there. But it is definitely something that requires a tremendous vigilance. And thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm really interested in taking a look at this quote trove that you have. It sounds very interesting. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Daniel DeSanto, and Brenton Octagall. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Epictetus. It is impossible to begin to learn that which one thinks one already knows. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.